From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a look back at 2014 and ahead to a brand new year. It's great to be back with you. What a year. In Ferguson, Missouri, uproar at the police shooting death this summer of an unarmed black man, Michael Brown, and tear gas in the air. It was the year Americans learned about ISIS. President Obama laid out his plan to confront ISIL, the so-called Islamic State. The president's bottom line?
Our objective is clear. We will degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL.
And as the year came to a close, incredibly, another Malaysian plane tragedy. Wreckage found families grieving. This hour on Point, our news roundtable with David Sanger of the New York Times, Molly Ball of the Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's going to matter out of 2014? What are you hoping for? What do you see coming in 2015? What's going to drive the news? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Weston, Vermont today is David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point, and happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year, Tom, and we're so glad to have you back on the air after what I know has been a really hard number of months, but it's great to hear your voice again.
It has been a perilous couple of months, and I am very happy to be here. And from Washington, Molly Ball joins us, political reporter for The Atlantic. Her big recent piece in The Atlantic, The End of the Obama Era. Molly, welcome back and Happy New Year to you as well.
Happy New Year, Tom, and it is wonderful to have you back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. My friend, hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. It is so good to have you back. Hello, David, and hello, Molly.
Great. I have to say just a word here on the personal front. It is my first time back at the microphone in nearly 2 months. As many of you know, in November, I lost my deeply loved wife to cancer. It was terrible and still is in many ways. But living, being in the stream of life is really the only answer. And I am so glad to be back with you all. Friendships really matter. And I want to thank all of our listeners across the country and truly around the world who were so supportive during those months. In addition to all kinds of support from friends and family, it meant a lot to me, and I thank you right here and right now. We are mortals, and the news this week, the news today that Mario Cuomo has gone. Molly, David, Jack, let's listen to just a little bit of the former governor of New York died yesterday, gave the keynote speech famously at the 1984 Democratic National Convention, criticizing then-President Ronald Reagan's policies.
A shining city is perhaps all the president sees from the portico of the White House and the veranda of his ranch, where everyone seems to be doing well. But there's another city. There's another part to the shining city, the part where some people can't pay their mortgages, and most young people can't afford one, where students can't afford the education they need, and middle-class parents watch the dreams they hold for their children evaporate.
Molly Ball, we'll look at Mario Cuomo, but you've been writing about the end of the Obama era. The midterm elections in November saw big wins for Republicans, majorities coming into 2015 in both houses of Congress. Where are we in the cycle of political chapters in this country that Mario Cuomo was defining in opposition to Ronald Reagan all those years ago?
Right. Well, and I called it the end of the Obama era in my sort of year-end piece for The Atlantic, because I do think that we are seeing a sort of torch-passing moment, a moment when, as Obama sort of officially enters his lame duck years, increasingly both parties will cease to focus on him as sort of the focal point of their activities. We see Democrats looking ahead potentially to the Hillary era or perhaps to somebody else. And Republicans also, I think the Republican Party has been defined for the last 6 years by their opposition to Obama and by the Tea Party, which I think really flourished as a reaction to Obama. And that we saw being marginalized over the course of this last year as Republicans sought candidates and messages that could be a little bit more welcoming and accessible than just this sort of party of no image. And so I think, there's been a lot of talk over the past month or so since the election about the things that Obama has been able to do. But I think he's going to struggle to remain relevant. And even if he does do the sort of dramatic executive actions that he's done in the last couple of months, it's not going to be the case that everything in politics sort of revolves around him.
Jack, how does the Mario Cuomo message echo today? All these years later, of course, he spoke well beyond 1984, but that was the bell ringer for this man. Maybe the high point of his rhetorical presence in this country. And you heard some of the message right there.
Oh, yes. You know, he could talk the birds out of the trees. I saw him give a speech at Salem State College. In the audience, many Italian elderly ladies dressed to the nines. You should have seen their faces. The pride, the delight when Cuomo, gesturing wide, said, "The deficit. You start to do the numbers on the blackboard of your mind, and pretty soon you're out the door and down the hall and standing next to the ladies' room." Boy, he could talk. He had the tongue of a poet, a bard, really, of urban liberalism, a champion of helping hand government, an eloquent voice for those he called the luckless and the left out.
But David Sanger, here we are. Big Republican majorities and Americans not turning down the Cuomo road right now. It's been the Obama road lately. What do you see in these midterms for, you know, telling us where Americans are interested in this country going now?
Well, you know, the first thing you have to remember about midterms is they have historically been a terrible predictor of what's going to happen in a presidential election because of the turnout, because of all the other reasons that we know. People tend to vote on party more in midterms and on individuals more in presidential elections. But I thought, listening to that clip of Mario Cuomo and reading Adam Nagorny, my colleague Adam Nagorny's fabulous obituary, it's in the Times today, and he had covered Cuomo for so many years. What you heard in Cuomo's voice there is the debate that's still going on in the Democratic Party between the Hillary wing and what, for lack of a better term, has become the Elizabeth Warren wing, with Cuomo and Elizabeth Warren sounding about the same, but Cuomo doing it with that incredible eloquence that Jack just described. The other interesting part of the Cuomo story, though, is that in the end, he had this great ambivalence about running for president himself. And remember the waiting jet that he never got on, you know, to take him off to
president. New Hampshire never went.
That's right. And maybe he knew Jack was waiting for him up there. Who knows, right? That was the other fascinating element of Mario Cuomo, this very public struggle with his own sense of whether he should run for president and what would have been had he done so.
Molly, of course, midterms, and especially in the second term of a two-term president, can be bad for the president's party. But this is the biggest Republican presence on the Hill since, what, the 1930s, since FDR was looking at Congress. Surely that is a kind of reading on Americans. We heard the NPR story this morning on how the Democratic Party is not doing well with white working class Americans, people who vote. And, of course, 16 more people vote of all colors and stripes, but there is a tell in this midterm vote anyway, and it will set the table for 2015, Molly.
Absolutely. And I think David made such a good point about that debate within the Democratic Party. And this is what we're going to be hearing so much about. I mean, and the interesting resonance that Cuomo has here is that on the one hand, his sort of vociferous liberalism, which he voiced in that 1984 speech and then continued to, was a loser for the Democratic Party in the 80s. And it was only when the triangulation of Bill Clinton came along in the 90s that the party was able to start winning again. Fast forward to today, of course, you have Hillary Clinton, who's seen as a continuation of her husband's sort of middle-of-the-road, pro-business, Democratic philosophy. And Andrew Cuomo's own son Mario Cuomo's son, Andrew Cuomo, in New York, is seen as being very much that sort of corporate Democrat, as the liberals like to call them, whereas the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, explicitly echoes what Mario Cuomo called that tale of two cities in his philosophy for New York City. So I think this is something we're going to hear a lot about. There's already a lot of wrestling in the Democratic Party with which way is the way to go, with whether to bring those white working class voters back. They need to double down on the sort of economic populism message, a more liberal message, or whether they need to tack to the middle to sort of respect the fact that there's been such a brushback from the midterms, and I don't think that's been decided at all.
Jack, 2016 will loom larger and larger in the year that we've just tiptoed into. What do you see coming? The GOP tilted away from the Tea Party in 2014 and did well in the midterms. How do you see the sort of Warren-Clinton back and forth going for the Democrats, Jack?
Well, I think that it's going to be Clinton all the way, with Warren providing some cue cards. I think we've already seen that. I just can't imagine that Elizabeth Warren would be so foolish as to run. I say foolish because here in New Hampshire, she is, I think the last poll was 57 points behind Hillary Clinton. She's a niche candidate. The niche is the, you know, the hardcore Democratic liberal who hears what they want to hear from her. But that isn't, speaking of, that's not a wide avenue for her. And I think in Iowa, the last I saw, she was 40 points behind Hillary. So it's just hard to imagine her getting in. It's easy to imagine her sort of laying down rhetorical markers.
Does that mean that her outlook is 40 points behind Hillary's outlook, Jack?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think her outlook has broader appeal, and Hillary is already beginning to, to imitate it. And in fact, Hillary's going beyond it. At one speech in Boston, she said something like, "Business doesn't create jobs." I thought, what is she talking about? She doesn't have to go that far.
Hello, Bill Clinton on line two for Hillary, maybe right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a year in the news, 2014, and the year right in front of us right now. It is January 2nd, 2015. We're just tiptoeing in with Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic, David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, and our own Jack Beatty. Big Republican wins in the midterm elections. They've got the House and the Senate now. Here was Republican Mitch McConnell talking about maybe working with the president.
Some things don't change after tonight. I don't expect the president to wake up tomorrow and view the world any differently than he did when he woke up this morning. He knows I won't either. But look, we do have an obligation to work together on issues where we can agree.
There are politics in the chambers of Washington. There were politics in the streets as well in 2014, out of Ferguson, Missouri, and well beyond New York City and well beyond. In early December, after the grand jury decisions to not indict police officers in Ferguson and New York City, the president spoke to the nation about racial tensions between law enforcement and minorities in communities around the country.
We recognize this is an American problem and not just a black problem or a brown problem or a Native American problem. This is an American problem. When anybody in this country is not being treated equally under the law, that's a problem. And it's my job as president to help solve it.
Molly Ball says the Obama era is ending. We'll see what he can solve, what he can't solve. David Sanger, just look back at 2014 for a second. You've got a lot of global perspective from your perch there as well. What really mattered out of 2014, David? What are we going to live with from the year that has just ended?
Well, I've got a list of two or three things. I was afraid you were going to ask me that, Tom.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of the year, we thought that Vladimir Putin was on the rise. There was a lot of talk about a renewed Cold War, which may or may not come to be true. But certainly he had taken Crimea, and it looked like Russia was punching back. By the end of the year, oil was at $55 a barrel. The Russian economy was headed into deep recession, and Vladimir Putin was really on the ropes. And that's, I think, going to be one of the most fascinating meta stories of 2015.
How does it matter beyond the borders of Russia? If Russia punches again or crumples, where's the impact?
Well, the impact is throughout Europe, which was suddenly after Crimea, reorganizing and revitalizing NATO to defend those former Soviet states, Estonia, for example, that are right on the Russian border and felt threatened next. It affects our dealings with Iran, where Russia's help has been absolutely critical, and it's possible that you may see the Russians try to dig out of this hole right now by being more helpful on Iran. The relationship between the U.S. and Iran was also one of the fascinating elements of the year that I think will really resound in 2015. President Obama made it very clear that if you could get past the nuclear issues, there was the possibility of a broad new relationship with Iran. And the Iranian leadership really was stunned and didn't know how to go deal with this, because on the one hand, we're on the same side in the conflict against ISIS, something we'll take up later on. But on the other hand, the legitimacy of the Iranian leadership depends on, at least in the minds of the supreme leader, Khamenei, depends on this continuing anti-American revolution. And then across the other side of the globe, you see a tiny little country with a lot less strategic significance, but a lot of emotional significance for us in Cuba, decide that 60 years of a relationship based on opposing the United States really wasn't getting them anywhere, and to do a big turnaround. Now, it would be a lot harder to do that with Iran, but it is going to be a fascinating experiment.
Jack, we always talk about if Martians landed on the planet and weren't in the stream of news, what would they think of what they saw? I'm a little bit in that boat after a couple of months away. Look back on 2014. What do you think will really matter, really resonate out of the year we've just closed, Jack, as we move forward?
Well, I really think that the reaction to Ferguson and Staten Island, it lit up a problem beyond white cops killing unarmed black men. The problem, as Nick Kristof argued in five powerful New York Times columns, of whites just not getting it. They don't get it, he points out, when, according to one study, the average white believes that anti-white racism is a worse problem than anti-black racism. They don't get it when, like a man who tweeted Kristof, they say, blacks don't get it. Choosing to be cool versus getting good grades is a bad choice. We all start from zero. In fact, white families start with an average net worth of $110,000, black families with $6,000, a gap greater than that in apartheid South Africa. You know, Kristof calls for Truth and Reconciliation Commission a la South Africa to sort of open a race conversation. That would be good for whites who don't get it, but would a national focus on their disadvantage be good for blacks? Here's Jesse Jackson campaigning for president. He said, "Grievance is too heavy a burden to bear. You have to turn around and look back to pick it up. And then, when you're carrying it, you can't go forward."
Molly, we've seen cultural politics, racial politics in the streets, but how will they or will they come into the politics of Congress, of Washington, in the year ahead?
I don't know. I mean, it is not the case that any of these battles in the streets have really translated into policy battles, especially at the federal level. There was some talk after Ferguson about doing something to look at this problem of the militarization of police forces, and some of that is continuing. There has, in fact, been some bipartisan momentum for criminal justice reform, with a lot of more libertarian-leaning Republicans joining with Democrats to want to change sentencing laws and improve the prison overpopulation problem in this country. But beyond those sort of incremental steps that chip away sort of at the margins of the problem, you don't see a sort of grand momentum. And one of the really regrettable hallmarks of the Obama era that we've seen is the increasing racialization of the political parties, particularly in the South. You know, I've covered a lot of elections in the Deep South this year, since that's where a lot of them were. And in states like Louisiana and Mississippi these days, you have a black party and a white party. And there really is not a lot of cross-pollination. And that's a really dangerous thing, a lot of people in those places say. That's a really really regrettable thing to have happen. So I don't know what is going to come of that. So, you know, as in terms of what the Congress is going to do in the new year, it'll be interesting to see whether they do try to engage with any of these issues, which have certainly caught the attention of everyday Americans much more than the kinds of things Congress actually talks about, you know, like trade or tax reform.
How do you square the place we are right now on race, Molly, with the fact that we're in the, you know, sixth year and now counting of the first African-American president? You talk about the end of the Obama era. If we are now in that phase, what can be said about these sort of side-by-side realities, first African-American president and racial politics back in the streets?
Well, you know, President Obama was asked about this the other day. I believe it was an interview on NPR. And he said that he does think that race relations have improved. And you know, the president is somebody who always likes to take a long view and to look at how history is going to judge things rather than sort of be caught up in the conflagration of the moment. And so his point was that if you look at the larger hallmarks of racial progress, you can see progress being steadily made. He's very much someone who subscribes to this view that the long arc of history does bend toward justice. And so if we look past these sort of incidental flare-ups, there is a narrative, an overall narrative of progress. I think that's something that he would like to believe in, and it may well be true. It probably depends on where you're standing.
Incidental flare-ups or a culture coming to terms with its own fissures. You know, people talk that white privilege has suddenly become part of the national parlance at the same time as the president likes to talk about progress being made. It's a very complicated picture. In terms of material steps in Congress, Keystone may come up as early as next week. The pipeline that could have tar sands oil flowing out of Canada through this country. How does that look, Molly? It was very close last year. What's it look like in the Republican-dominated Capitol Hill?
Well, there's almost no question that Republicans now have the votes to get Keystone through the Congress. There's a couple, since it fell short by only one vote in the previous Congress, which, of course, had more Democrats in the Senate than Republicans. But the question then is what the president is going to do. And so this could be a larger symbolic vote in terms of how the president and Congress, how much they're going to want to come together in the coming session with the all-Republican-dominated Congress. The president has not said for sure whether he would veto a congressional authorization of the Keystone Pipeline. But toward the end of last year, he was making noises that sounded more and more negative toward it, mostly on sort of procedural grounds. He feels that this is his decision. He's been putting it off for a long time. He's been under a lot of pressure from the left wing of his party and the environmentalists to go against it. But you sort of sense that his own instincts are not necessarily totally against it. But he does seem to feel strongly that it is his decision, and to be sort of goaded into it by the Congress would not be correct. It'd be very interesting to see if there is any desire on the parts of the White House and Congress to make this a part of some larger deal on other issues that they would like to get done. But what we just don't know is if the Congress were to simply pass the Keystone Pipeline without a lot of other stuff that Obama doesn't like attached to it, would he veto it? We don't know that.
If it stands on its own. And if they would, and if he vetoes, is that definitive or is there a chance of an override?
I don't think there's a chance of an override. It just takes too many votes. Republicans have solid majorities in both houses, but they don't have that many votes.
Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Tom. Happy New Year. And thank you for being a man and looking after your wife while she was going through cancer and passing away. I see the Republicans paying back all their people that bought the election, and in the long run, the taxpayers are going to be paying many times over for the mess that's going to be created.
What's the mess that you foresee, Terry?
Well, the Keystone Pipeline, they won't address the problem with policing and the situation with
I guess
there's a
climate aspect, obviously, to the pipeline. There's the pipeline safety on the Ogallala Aquifer and all the rest. People can look for a lot of places for mess. Terry, I appreciate your call very much. David Sanger, tie this into that $55 a barrel oil issue that you raised, which is having huge implications, as you say, for Russia, for Iran, Saudi Arabia, where the monarchy is in its own pickle right now, an aging king as we speak, and nobody knows exactly where that's going. How does is there a fulcrum here between the Canadian oil and then take us on to that cheaper oil than we have seen in a long, long time, David, and how that's likely to play out in 2015.
Well, this is really the multi-shot piece of foreign policy and economics. We've already discussed the Russia element of it. There's obviously a big domestic element of it. One of the reasons that the Saudis, who, as you say, are in another phase of their perpetual leadership turmoil due to the illness of the king, basically had two objectives when they were letting the oil drop to this level. So obviously, they're making a lot less money, mm-hmm. but they're getting two things out of it. One is they wanted to break the frackers, those in the United States who have been adding to supply by doing the fracking work. We can have a separate environmental discussion about that. But to the Saudis, this was a big long-term threat. And they knew that if they could drive the price down, they could drive a lot of those frackers out of business.
Is that happening, David? Or are they hanging in for, I don't know, how long can American fracking hang in at $55 a barrel?
You know, it's all a matter of time, and each one of them has got a different price point.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly when you've looked at those places where unemployment has been very low in the United States, up in the Dakotas, every place else where yep. the fracking's happening, you're seeing those rates begin to creep back up. So that's one element of it, and we don't know how long they can hold on. The other part of the Saudi strategy was to break the Iranians, because it's Iran, if it got back on the oil market, that would manage to, if the sanctions were lifted, would manage to add more oil to the supply here. And it's not in the Saudis' interest or in the Russian interest right now to see the sanctions lifted on Iran, because both of them would suffer. But this also takes you back to the pipeline. When the president was talking about the pipeline in one of his year-end interviews, I think it was the one with Candy Crowley, but I could have that wrong,
mm-hmm.
He began to talk about how little economic benefit there was from it. And I'm sure that in the president's mind, just given what we've seen about how he approaches these issues, this is a cost-benefit analysis for him. And he's probably thinking, based on what he's said, that the environmental risk is relatively high for a relatively low payoff, and that you're getting a lot more oil out of $55 prices and out of the fracking, and that it may be too inconsequential in addition to the American economy to be worth the environmental risk.
Jack Beatty, I am fascinated by the oil price and the Saudis' oil in it. They've kept the spigots open even as oil has gone down and down and down. David Sanger says they'd like it to hit American frackers hard and maybe take some of them out. Alternative fuel developers, of course, hit as well when the price gets that low. A lot of geopolitical consequences there, too. I mean, I would love to be able to X-ray the decision to let this price go so far down, Jack. How do you read the Saudis here?
Well, I think David's got that right. I mean, they're willing to play a long game here, and that's good news, really, for most of the American economy. And already, oil prices are showing up in the Michigan Consumer Confidence Index. 2009, it was 59. Now it's 89. That fits into a picture with the Dow at historic highs, with the economy growing at a 5% clip in the third quarter, inflation barely noticeable, deficit lowest level since 2008. And finally, wages, by some estimate, may be beginning to tick up. Unemployment fallen from 10% in October 2009 to 5.8% in November. Someone wrote the other day, these are really the good old days. Well, maybe not, but they're a lot better than they've been in some time. And oil price drop, real big reason why.
Molly, 20 seconds before the break, but will Washington stand by and watch American fracking go out of business? It's been such a game changer in the last decade.
Well, I do think, as David said, it casts a whole different light on the pipeline decision if it doesn't look like it's particularly necessary to get this extra oil out of the ground with people getting cheap gas everywhere else.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, 2014, and it's other news. Brazil hosted the World Cup. Germany won.
He's found a cross, and here's Mario Götze. What a goal! What a goal to win a World Cup!
More than 20 women have accused Bill Cosby of assaulting them. Cosby isn't commenting. Here was that awkward interview with the AP in November.
I think you were told, I don't want to compromise your integrity, but I don't talk about it.
And the final episode of The Colbert Report aired in December, a show that helped define a decade. Stephen Colbert, who will take over for David Letterman, laid it out.
Folks, if this is your first time tuning into The Colbert Report, I have some terrible news. This, in fact, is your last time tuning into The Colbert Report.
And that's behind us. It's January 2nd, 2015. We're looking at a week in the news, a year in the news, and the year ahead with David Sanger of The New York Times, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us. What's your big hope for 2015? What will you be watching? David Sanger, here's Jack writing to us on Facebook saying, I'm really distressed that we can leave 10,000-plus American service persons in harm's way and declare the war in Afghanistan is over. What about that? How many are there now, David? And what is the American commitment now that we're into 2015 in Afghanistan?
Well, it's about 10,600, I think, something in that range. But your reader there or listener raises a very good question. So why is it that the administration, even while declaring that it was an end to combat operations, wanted to leave some presence? Partly it's as a backup to preserve the government from falling in Kabul. They don't think Kabul could be taken, but we've seen the Taliban take a lot of other sections of Afghanistan, and we've essentially decided to go live with that. Part of it is intelligence gathering, that you need those bases as part of a way to maintain an intelligent sense of what the Taliban is doing and to maintain some capability to move across into Pakistan as well. This is not unusual in historical sense when you think about the fact that we still have troops in Japan, we still have troops in Germany, and we still have troops in South Korea. All of those were the result of the ends of wars that we were fighting in which we left a presence thereafter.
But those were truly the ends of wars. Those were settled conflicts, David. This seems anything but.
Those were settled conflicts, Tom. And, you know, we knew from going into the Afghan one, you weren't going to have a settled conflict of any kind. And you never are, right? Well, let's back up. I would not say that Korea was a settled conflict. In fact, we've had pretty good evidence in the past couple of weeks that there are elements of it that are highly unsettled.
Fair enough. But at least there was a border. There was a boundary somewhere between hostile forces. You've got Taliban in Kabul now. I mean, is there still the risk of a kind of rooftop helicopter exodus Saigon style in Afghanistan?
There is certainly that risk. I think people think the risk of that happening in Kabul itself is fairly low. But there is, I think, a bigger risk that the government in Afghanistan basically has a reach that goes very little beyond Kabul. And that would suggest that you're not going to have a country that can be under a single central government. And you'll remember that 10 years ago, more than that, when the United States went into Afghanistan in 2001, there were people warning that Afghanistan's never had a strong central government, and that you have to basically put together coalitions of tribes, and you have, of course, all the ethnic issues that we've been discussing for the past decade. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you're not going to have a unified country, and that's one reason that this looks so different in many ways than those previous cases. Now, the administration has also said that that 10,000 group is not there indefinitely. It's not going to be like Germany or Japan or Korea, and then in a year or two, they will be out.
Molly Ball, we've got troops still in Afghanistan, though combat operations were told over. Iraq ended under President Obama's watch, sort of. Now we've got troops there again. What's the level of support in Washington for these ongoing operations, Molly?
I don't know, and that's another debate that'll be interesting if the Congress ends up having it. As you remember, right before the election, there was a very sort of quick sort of sweep it under the rug vote to not exactly authorize what the president, the action that the president was taking to escalate against the Islamic State, but to allow it to happen. It was a funding measure rather than an authorization measure. And at the time, there was a lot of talk about going back to that. We haven't heard that much talk in the last couple of months because because, you know, this is such a hot potato that I don't think Congress wants to handle it any more than anybody else does. Among the voices calling for more explicit authorization for what the president is doing in Iraq and Syria, you had some like Rand Paul saying we need to put more limits on it. We need to have a narrow, more focused authorization so that there are things that the president knows he can't do. You also had a lot of other Republicans saying, no, it needs to be broader. We would like to see boots on the ground. We would like to see a more forceful effort to combat the Islamic State. So to bring those two sides together, it would be very difficult, and wouldn't be too surprising if Congress just decided to sort of duck the issue and let this stay on the White House, since it's not an easy topic for anyone.
We'll look at the Islamic State, Jack Beatty, in Afghanistan. A lot of murk here. Combat operations over, but troops right there. Murky territory, Jack.
It is indeed. And, you know, it's tough to quote the Taliban, but I really think they had something right here. They put out this statement. Today, ISAF, the coalition, rolled up its flag in an atmosphere of failure and disappointment without having achieved anything tangible. Tens of thousands of soldiers were killed and wounded, billions of dollars wasted, their generals failed one after another, and they lost their stature and prestige. Maybe there's some exaggeration in that, but of a 13-year war, 2,356 dead Americans, $1 trillion spent, more money in real terms than we spent on the Marshall Plan. Can anybody really look at this and say, yeah, this was a great American success?
Well, between that kind of statement out of the Taliban and the Islamic State's statements, they got some PR people working for them, Jack. That's polished Madison Avenue kind of stuff. Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. Kathleen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, one hope that I have, big hope I have for this coming year is that the Obama administration continues to deal with Iran, negotiate with Iran, based on hard facts. As signatories to the NPT, I know they have the legal right to enrich up to 20% for peaceful purposes. And so instead of being pushed into possibly another military confrontation by the same warmongers that pushed us into Iraq, let's hope that Iran or that the U.S. continues to negotiate with them, again, based on hard facts. And I wish you guys would do a whole program on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, how who signed, who didn't. And I also hope the Obama administration would push Israel into signing the NPT, because we know they sit on, you know, large stockpiles of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. So that's my hope for this coming year.
Kathleen, let's pick it up. David Sanger, the negotiations with Iran, they bogged down at the end of the year, but they didn't go away. How do you see those likely unfolding in the year ahead and the interests in the irons in that fire?
Well, I was out in Vienna for the last decision in November to extend these talks, and of course it was the second extension. I don't have a lot of optimism that you're going to see the Iranian leadership agree to a comprehensive agreement. If they were going to do that, I think they would have done it back either in July or November.
So what happens?
But I think what you are going to see is sort of managed ambiguity for the future, in which we see continued extensions of these agreements, perhaps with partial agreements along the way, more like the Mideast peace process than a full agreement. Now, there's something that might change that. And it's the $55 barrel oil we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, because the sanctions were already hurting Iran when oil was at 100. You can imagine that little oil that they're managing to get out, about half of what they were able to ship prior to the sanctions, is now bringing in a lot less revenue. And that might change views among the leadership. So far, it hasn't, but it's the best thing the United States has going for it. Kathleen raised a very interesting question, which is, essentially, is the United States recognizing a right to enrich for the Iranians? And I think one of the lessons of 2014 is, yes, the U.S. is. I think the administration has agreed that if you can show that that's entirely peaceful, they've got no objection to some amount of enrichment taking place. The difficulty is making sure that the enrichment levels are low enough that Iran couldn't race for a bomb without the U.S. and everybody else having significant warning. And that's really what this negotiation is all about. It's on a number of very complex moving parts to make sure that you've got at least a year's warning time and maybe more. And that's what's been so hard to get to.
I want to bring it home to immigration issues. The president taking executive action last year, it got a lot of flack from Republicans and other critics. On the other hand, huge pressure in this country to do something about immigration. Here was President Obama in November, outlined his plan to give legal status to up to 5 million people in the country illegally. He said he was only acting because Congress would not.
To those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill. I want to work with both parties to pass a more permanent legislative solution.
Mully Ball, any chance of something like that arising in this new year with this new Congress?
In a word, no. But it's going to be very interesting to see how the new Congress handles this. This is the real litmus test that is coming up for the new Republican Congress. And there really is not a game plan. I've been talking to sources in the Republican leadership of both houses about how they're going to handle this. As you recall, they succeeded in funding the government at the end of 2014, except for the Department of Homeland Security, which is only funded through February. And that's because Homeland Security oversees immigration. And they want to have a chance with the new Republican members of Congress to relitigate this issue and to try to find a way to push back symbolically against the president. There's not much they can do in substantive terms, although some of the conservatives don't accept that. They think there must be some way to stop the president. And so this is going to be a case of whether the leadership can get their more sort of unruly members to accept something that may be purely symbolic as a pushback to the president for a policy that they don't like but are pretty much powerless to stop. So, you know, and this is dangerous territory for Republicans. We just had a member of the Republican leadership in the House involved in a big controversy about whether he spoke to a white supremacist group in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So these issues of race and identity and diversity for Republicans who are trying to present a more inclusive face to the world going into the 2016 presidential election, which of course is going to be the big political news story of this year, that's something that they're grappling with, and they're very leery of all of the ways that this could backfire on them.
Molly, what about areas of potential cooperation here? We read that the president, at the Times and elsewhere, the president has a strategy that he wants to try and work with Congress. That hymn book didn't work out so well for him in the past. Are there areas here? Is there terrain where that could be productive?
Well, you know, you played that clip from Mitch McConnell's speech, which I was there for. That was his election night speech. Yeah. in Kentucky. And there's a sort of fine print to it, right? There's a sort of asterisk where he says, we do want to work together on the areas where we agree. Well, what are those? There really aren't that many. Now, if they can only agree to keep the government open and fund the government and not have these crises, that would itself be progress, considering what we've seen over the past several years, even if it doesn't go beyond that. There are not big policy areas where Republicans and Democrats have large areas of agreement. There's been some talk about things like tax reform, which I think there are just too many landmines embedded in an issue like that. Potentially trade, where Obama is at odds with some liberal Democrats about over free trade agreements, and most Republicans want to see that done. I think that's a possibility. I don't think there are big policy issues where you're going to see the White House and Republicans coming together. So it's just a question of how acrimonious it's going to be, how many vetoes, how much heated rhetoric. A lot of it may be a matter of, can they just present a face of bipartisanship and working together, even if they're not getting a whole lot done.
Just to keep the government running. Pretty low bar, but maybe that's the bar in 2015. Kim in Rock Island, Illinois. Kim, thank you for calling.
Happy New Year, and I'm looking forward. Pope Francis rocks. I mean, if he can get the Vatican to realize that, you know, nobody should be getting wealthy off the church, we should be able to get people to understand nobody should be getting wealthy off our government.
Kim, I appreciate your call. Pope Francis has turned out to be a very interesting guy. We're going to talk more about him on Monday. David, let me come to you on that one. The Pope, there he is in the Cuba decision. There he is talking with Islamic leaders. Beyond the church itself, how much sway do you see in this Pope? How much influence, David?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who believe that in the end, the Cuban agreement might not have been reached without him. I'm not sure if that's an overstatement or not, but certainly the last set of agreements took place under the Pope's auspices at the Vatican. It's unusual to imagine the Vatican being a diplomatic center, but it has been. And it was for a very deliberate reason, because his embrace of this reconciliation between the United States and Cuba carries huge moral sway, obviously, with the Cuban people. So it was absolutely critical. And if you could see him play a similar role elsewhere, I think people think that would be terrific. There are risks in that for the Pope. It gets him involved in some pretty earthly diplomacy. Mm. There are risks in that if there's failure. And so the chances that he might have similar sway in a problem, say, like ISIS, seems far more limited. But it has been a really remarkable change from the role his predecessors played.
As I say, we'll dig in on Pope Francis on Monday. Jack, your hopes for 2015? Reasonable hopes, sir, from your perch watching the country and the world?
Well, I'm with Kathleen. I really hope that we can work a deal with Iran this year. That would be a deliverance for the president, his legacy, for the rest of the world, an avoidance of another preventive war. We don't need that in this country.
We've been at that for a long time, and a lot of soldiers out there still. Jack, thanks very much for being with us today. It's great to be with you again. Thanks for all your support. Boy, being up there with you and Lois by your fire in New Hampshire when things were tough meant a lot to me, Jack, and I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
It meant a lot to us. Thank you.
David Sanger in Weston, Vermont, my old friend. David, it's good to have your warm voice with us today. We wish you the best for 2015. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you, Tom, and we'll be thinking of you even as you get back to work here this year.
We're waiting back in. And Molly Ball, it's always wonderful to talk with you, Molly. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you, Molly.
Happy New Year. Welcome back, Tom.
Molly Ball at The Atlantic. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.